your host, Dave Woods. This is the radio show that puts country music front and center. Spend some time in the country and get to know our guests. Spend some time in the country where the music's the best. The latest news and memories, two great stories that get told.
Country legend Hank Williams died on New Year's Day, 1953. 5 days later, his daughter was born and went on to be adopted by Hank's mother and then another family who raised her. But it wasn't until her 21st birthday that Jet Williams learned the truth about who her biological parents were, Hank Williams and Bobby Jet. She details that discovery in her book, Ain't Nothing As Sweet As My Baby, The Story of Hank Williams' Lost Daughter, published in 1990. And as you might guess, the musical genes of Hank were passed down to his daughter. She's a singer and songwriter and proud of her father's legacy. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Jet Williams to the show. Hi, Jet.
Hey, how are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing just terrific. So great to speak with you.
Well, I'm proud to be on your show, and I like that the intro song. I'm glad country music's always been steadfast in Canada, and I'm glad y'all are still, you know, holding on to those country roots.
We love country music here, and this show, as you've heard from the opening, is all about country music. And growing up in my household, as a young one, I heard Hank Williams all the time. My dad is a huge fan of your father's music.
Well, I tell you what, his music is alive and well and today as I think even more so and
yeah.
Around, and it's not just in the United States and Canada but around the world. I mean, his fans are just still there listening to the music and with the Mother's Best radio shows, which I'm sure we'll talk about later in the show.
Yep.
All those unreleased recordings, brought back a lot of people that were his fans, but it's also reintroduced him, and it's also brought in another whole batch of folks that say, had heard of Hank Williams, but maybe, at this time in their life, that particular kind of country music didn't suit them. So there's, I cannot tell you all the letters and cards and emails and everything that we get on this, it's old new material, so to speak.
Right. It's so amazing that after all this time and now with the new Mother's Best recordings, as you said, new old music, that, he's timeless. What do you think that is attributed to, that people to this day still love his music and still find something in it that resonates in their lives?
Well, when you say the real thing, he was the real thing. And not only could he deliver the song vocally to where, when he sang it, you felt like he sang it like his life depended on it. But the lyrics and the melodies are timeless because, when you can write a song like The Silence of a Falling Star Lights Up a Purple Sky, and As I Wonder Where You Are, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, and that's the song. It doesn't take, so many words and trying to be so clever and, it's a masterpiece, and he wasn't a one-time artist, but those words that he wrote resonated around the world because people felt like he wrote it just for them. And I don't care if you're Canadian, American, or whatever, when your heart breaks, it breaks the same
way.
Yes,
indeed.
And so
indeed.
When you hear that, you look across and you see a good-looking gal, or I see a good-looking guy, and you think, hey, good-looking, what you got cooking? I mean, that's just, those are human emotions and nature that people identify with. And, when you have a song that can actually bring on a physical reaction, whether it be a smile, a laugh, a tear, or just a melancholy, then you know that that song is just not just a heart tugger. It's one of those ones that goes into your bone marrow.
And that's the thing with him. His music ran on the deep side of things, as you mentioned, referring to I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. And then we've got Hey Good Looking and Move It On Over, songs with some humor in them, a lot of humor in them. So he could really do that, a sort of a song for every occasion, every kind of mood that we're in.
Not only on the, that's what I always said, people would myth spinners would like you to believe that this guy was, you know, foresaw his death. He was so lonesome, you know. You don't sing stuff like "Hey, good looking jambalaya, move it on over, setting the woods on fire." You know, all of these, up tempo. I mean, even my tear in my beer. And if you listen to a lot of this, to his masters, like your Cheating Heart, Cuckold Heart, they're actually they were made to be jukebox friendly. They were made to make people get up and dance. You know, not sit there and cry in their beer. They were made to make you want to put that nickel in that jukebox and get up and dance. But the other thing in his song structures, a lot of singers either do up-tempo or they do what they call the rolling ballads or whatever. Well, he was writing waltzes in 4-4, and the way he'd structure it, Cold Cold Heart was like four verses, and then you're Cheating Heart to be a verse, a chorus, a bridge, a verse, and a chorus. So all of his structures, he didn't write just one kind of a song. And then when he got into the Luke the Drifter and the recitations, like The Funeral and Men with Broken Hearts and all of those, I mean, and the guy dies at 29 years old. You know, you think that this guy, Hank Williams, was just this old guy that, wrote all these things and sang all these hits.
It's amazing because to have that body of work, you would assume, and anybody not knowing too much about your father would assume he lived a long life because he has so many songs. You know, to do that by the age of 29, to have lived that much and written that much is amazing.
Well, I use that, the timeline, too, is that he actually didn't get, when he came to Nashville, he was hired by Fred Rose to be a songwriter, okay, just to write songs for Molly O'Day, okay, not to be a singer. And it wasn't until later that Fred Rose says, you sing. And he went down to Montgomery to catch a show and was so impressed he signed him to a record deal. But when my dad came, he was just writing music, and then he went on to cut on Sterling Records, and he got paid $82.50 for the record. I know.
Wow.
And then that led to MGM forming a branch of the record company, which my dad actually started the MGM Country Division. And the hit that made it for him, that actually, launched him into the national spotlight, was a song called "Move It On Over." And then from there he went, and it wasn't until the June of 1949, that he actually made a guest appearance on the Grand Ole Opry, at which time he sang the Lovesick Blues as a guest on the Opry. And then, of course, that was the beginning of the superstardom. I mean, from that mid-49 to 52, that was when he had reached the zenith there.
It's amazing for that short period of time, his career was just hot as anything, and all these songs came out just amazing. And that, talk about talent to do that much, achieve that much.
Well, I also go to, if you think about this too, because the Miss Spinners would have you, I'm not saying that my dad didn't drink, but if he was as drunk as all of the, some of the people would like to believe, I say to them, then how in the heck did this guy in three years, give or take, write all the songs, make all the recordings, do all the radio shows, make all the personal appearances, do all the opera shows, do the television shows, and do all of this in like 3 years with no internet and no Facebook, Twitter, or any of the newspapers, and even if he was on the Kate Smith, Perry Como, but back then, who owned a television? I mean, this guy did it all through a battery-operated radio, which, when you start, making that distinction there, you have to really reconsider this guy drinking that much, because if that was the truth, he could not have physically achieved all that he did.
Exactly, and probably the way he lived, that came out in his music and the different kinds of songs, and his heart got broken, and he had these wild times, but, maybe if he lived a different kind of life, he wouldn't have been able to share all those experiences.
Well, one thing, and I have a radio show here in the United States on Sirius XM Radio, And so I do a lot of the history. And one thing that I was talking about last week is that you take that my dad was born in the 20s. And I know in Canada as well as the United States, the 20s and the 30s were really hard, hard scrapping times. I mean, people actually had to scratch out a living. I mean, my dad was selling, you know, as a child, he was shining shoes and selling peanuts and, you know, just whatever they could scrape up. But if you look at the music that came out during the 30s and the Depression in the United States and the way the world was, there was a lot of creativity and a lot of heartbreak and depression and things like that that I think added to that kind of a blue sadness that tints some of the great songs that we have today.
And as I've talked with other artists on the show and songwriters, those sad songs that we listen to don't always bring us down. Sometimes they comfort us because we know somebody else is going through that same thing. So those sad songs, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, for example, can comfort us.
Oh, absolutely. And to me, it's that particular song's a melancholy song, and the fact that it's interesting, if you really look at the words, it doesn't talk about, it never identifies who you're lonesome for.
Right.
I mean, so it could be say your wife, your husband, but it could be your child.
Yes.
It could be your friend. It could even be your pet. You know? I mean, so, you know, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, you know, about being so lonesome and just, you know, missing that something. So, you know, the thing about that particular song, I think that, you know, everybody can identify. And I also think it's one of the greatest works of poetry because it's really it paints a picture with words.
Yes, exactly. It does, and oftentimes people will say, you know, he wrote in a simple fashion, but sometimes simple, and that's not the best example of one of the simpler songs, but that can be very hard to do to make it something that we all understand.
Well, you're exactly right, and when you say all understand, but be able to apply it to you, you know, it's like he knows how I feel. And I know a lot of people have told me through the years, especially, you know, when they say they're losing a parent or something like that, especially if they're in my father's generation or whatever, that music gives them comfort because after a certain passage of time, that when they hear the music, it makes them remember and take that trip down memory lane and remember when Mama was probably scolding them all because they were up too late and then putting them to bed
right.
And singing, "Hey, good looking," and, you know, just, you know, Daddy sitting on the front porch and Grandpa, and, you know, just, you know, it allows you also to do a little time travel, but still, as I said today, I don't care how technologically savvy you are, when somebody hurts your feelings, your feelings are hurt, and that's not anything that you can go get on the internet and you know, feel or whatever. I mean, you know, but you go on the internet and you punch up a Hank Williams and you hear this song and you go, you know, that dude knows how I feel.
Exactly. He read my mind. That's how it feels. Let's talk about some of his other songs too here, Jet, Kalijah, which is such a unique story about the wooden Indian. It's a catchy song, and it's just very clever, but it holds your attention as you listen.
Actually, yes, it does. And the melody, it goes from from minors to majors, but the story on that particular song, my dad wrote that song in September of 1952. And it was on his very last session that he did. It was the A side of the MGM record, and the actual the Kalijah. He was at a fishing cabin, and the body of water is Kalijah Bay, because it's down in Alabama. But he apparently had been in a Pontiac dealership in Alex City, and the old hood ornaments on a Pontiac was Chief Pontiac. And the Pontiac is named after Chief Pontiac out of Michigan.
Okay? Right.
And the wooden, and all the Pontiac dealerships used to have wooden, not all, but a lot of them had the wooden Indian Chief Pontiac showroom floor. And so apparently my dad saw Chief Pontiac the Wooden Indian, and then went
right.
back to the fishing cabin and looked out over Kalija and wrote the song.
Amazing. What a story. And again, the song is just shows his diversity to go from a sad song to writing something as unique as that.
Well, I think it's more than a novelty song. And you know, when I do it for the audiences and people hear that song, in fact, my husband has it as his ringtone, okay? And we were out, and we had a young man with us, I don't know, about 18, I guess. And, of course, he had heard Hank Williams, but he didn't know a whole lot about him. And so the phone rang, and Kalija started playing and everything. And when my husband got off the phone, the young man said to my husband, he goes, "Now, what song is that? I want to get that for my ringtone, too." I love that. Because, you know, the phone
awesome.
Starts with the drum beating and everything. But anyway, so, you know, it's a real catchy tune. And you're absolutely right. It's very cleverly written, and it tells a really sweet story.
Now, Jet, how important were the Drifting Cowboys to Hank's success, and also as far as a friend being friends to him?
Well, I think they were critical. There were several different groups of Drifting Cowboys. The Drifting Cowboys he had when he started out in Montgomery, and then he had the Drifting Cowboys, which was Bob McNett, Hillis Buttram, Jerry Rivers, and Don Helms, and then. Then he went, after he made his debut on the Opry, Bob McNett and Hillis left, and they were Cedric Rainwater and Sammy Pruitt came on. But the main two guys, Don Helms and Jerry Rivers, the fiddle and the steel, when you listen to the Hank Williams music, that is the main two instruments. And with Don and my dad, they created the magic of being able to have the signature steel intros, and that steel guitar with my dad's voice made absolute magic. And Don and my dad were, and Jerry, were the best of friends on and off of the stage. And I think that made a magic that you just can't, you know, there was such a love there of friends and admiration for the talent that it's a magic that there's money can't, you just can't go hire somebody and create that.
Right. Yeah, you really need to have that connection with a fellow musician or singer to really have that magic happen, and it doesn't happen a lot, so that was something special they captured. Now, you also went on years later to tour with one version of the Drifting Cowboys.
I was fortunate enough for a number of years, and we played a lot in Canada, was to join up with Don Helms and Jerry Rivers. And I toured the world with them, and then Jerry unfortunately got sick, and then he passed. And then Don and I stayed together as long as his health permitted him to be able to travel. And, you know, the thing about it is actually going on the road, you know, all people want to, you know, go on the road and all this. It's a hard life.
I'll bet.
You know, especially when you're doing a show after a show, because I mean, you know, unless you've got a Learjet or a huge bus and a driver and all that, I mean, it's tough going, you know, going to sleep and getting up and going to the next city and living in a motel. The thing that it is like I tell people, it's like being a salesperson. You either go to the mall 8 to 5 or whatever, you know, Monday through Friday, and go home. And this, some people love that. But then there are other people that I think have that restlessness in them, and that road just calls them. And Don and Jerry were like that. I mean, they lived to go on the road and to play their music, but also to meet people and make that magic on stage.
We're going to come back in a few moments and get into, of course, the big event around your 21st birthday when you learned that Hank Williams was your father and Bobby Jett was your mother. We're also going to get into all the excitement of the Mother's Best recordings and that great discovery. But we're going to turn to music now, Jett, and move it on over. Hank Williams, of course, your father, and he wrote this song, performs it. It's a fun song. What can you tell us about it? Can you give us some insight into the song or something you particularly like about it?
This was the big hit he had, and one reason the way I did it was because there was a Bill Haley of sang Rock Around the Clock.
Yep.
But my dad did Moving On Over 8 years before Mr. Haley did his. And my dad is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame here in the United States. And when you hear Moving On Over, and then what I tell people is, listen to Moving On Over, but think about Rock Around the Clock, and you see if Mr. Haley rocked before Mr. Williams, because if you listen to Came In Last Night or When the Clock Strikes One, Came In Last Night, I mean, they're right on top of each other.
Yep. Exactly.
So
wow.
When I cut it, I did it more the big real rock kind of a, you know, just to show that song, you know, you can take it and just really take it to that next level.
And George Thorogood and the Destroyers recorded this song as well on a cover CD.
Oh, absolutely, and did a great job.
Yeah. So it's had a lot of life, the song. Let's turn to the original version now from your father, Hank Williams. This is Move It On Over here on In the Country.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in, so move it on over. Dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more. So get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, cause the fat dog's moving in. This dog house here is mighty small, but it's better than no house at all. So ease it on over. Drag it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, old dog, cause a new dog's moving in. Down, so pack it on over.
Move it on over.
Hold it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, nice dog, cause a mad dog's moving in. She warned me once, she warned me twice, but I don't take no one's advice, so scratch it on over.
Move it on over.
Shake it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, short dog, cause a tall dog's moving in.
Country legend Hank Williams in a song he wrote and recorded, one of his biggest hits, Move It On Over. And I am speaking with the daughter of Hank Williams, Jet Williams. Now, Jet, I've had a chance recently to read your book, fascinating, Ain't Nothing As Sweet As My Baby. What was it like writing that book?
Well, you know, I tell you what, it's really hard to write an autobiography because, you know, you're really tempted to say, I did this and I did that, and so, you know, to try and keep it interesting. And the other thing is it's hard because when you grow up as an adult and you think back on your childhood and things that happened in your life, I think you tend to see them through rose-colored glasses and think things weren't near as bad as you thought they were. And then when you actually have to go back and relive these episodes in your life and everything, it was pretty heart-wrenching.
I'll bet, yeah, to go to the past and relive all these stories and talk about the big revelation. Now share with us that moment, a huge moment in your life on your 21st birthday when your adopted parents told you that Hank Williams might possibly be your father.
Well, As you said earlier in the introduction, is that my father died 5 days before I was born. And when I was born, my natural mother, who I never met, gave me, my grandmother, Hank's mother, adopted me. And everything was supposedly planned, and then she died, and I went to a foster home, and I was later adopted. But anyway, my adopted parents came to the college I was at, and they parted the information that that a man by the name of Hank Williams might be my father, but there wasn't any proof, and there wasn't anything I could do, and that everything had been decided. And I believed them. Everything I read, that's what it said, was that there wasn't, you know, I couldn't find anything. So it wasn't until my adopted dad called me, and at this time he had cancer, and I think he knew he was going to die. And he said that if I wanted to find out who my natural parents were, he would do everything to help me, but not to tell my adopted mother because she had some mental problems.
Right.
And so with that release, so to speak, I went on my journey to find out who I was and what happened. Of course, I hit brick wall after brick wall after brick wall, and by chance I met an attorney by the name of Keith Atkinson, who was able to help me, and it ended up one of the things that was what they would call the smoking gun. A three-page document surfaced in which it was a notarized document in which my father stated that he was the father of this unborn child, and that he was getting full custody of this child, and he would support this child, and it would live with him. And and so as an adult, all I wanted to do was find out if Hank Williams was my father. That was it. But better than that, I got a notarized document from my daddy saying, not only
wow.
am I your father, I want you. And with that knowledge that I was wanted by my father, I wouldn't, you know, just, you know, well, I don't want anything to do with this or whatever. I mean, he
yeah.
went to his lawyers, had it drawn up. He wanted me. And with that, I made an announcement, and then I got sued. But
amazing.
The thing about it is I laugh and say I was the best-kept secret in country music. Everybody knew but me, because the administrators and attorneys from my father's estate kept the estate open for 23 years. So Hank Jr. Knew I existed, and he had to wait for me to reach – he's older than I am. So he had to wait for me to reach my majority and then run the statutes in which they did not notify me. And so the courts here in the United States ruled, because letters went back and forth saying, are you sure we shouldn't give her the money? And they said, no, we got her buried. She'll never find out. Let sleeping dogs lie. And so because the administrators and attorneys knew who I was, knew where I was, and had put half the money in a trust for me, and then, you know, said, well, we're not going to notify her, the courts ruled that they defrauded me. And that's how I was ruled the daughter of Hank Williams and then awarded his estate as an heir.
Amazing. What a battle to go through, but with a great outcome. I guess it was the late 80s, around 87, that the judge rulings came down, and it was official. It was made official to everyone.
Well, absolutely. You know, but the thing that it is whether the judge said it or not, the
right.
only thing that really counted to me was that my dad signed a paper that was notarized before. And see, he took me sight unseen, okay? I mean, it wasn't like, well, if it's a boy, I'll take it. If it's a girl, I'm not. You know, if it's healthy, I'll keep it. If it's not, you
right.
get it. You know, I mean, it was an unconditional, I'm the dad, and I'm taking it. And, I mean, things that he did, like when he left on that last trip, for the folks that are listening, he left to go on to do a show, actually, in Charleston, West Virginia, on New Year's Eve of 1952, and then on to Canton, Ohio. One of the things he did before he left money with his mother, and a letter saying, I'm the father, I will take care of all of the hospital bills. And he left money with his mother so that if he was afraid the baby was going to be born before he could get back, and so he wanted cab fare and everything to be taken care of before he left on that trip, you
wow.
know, just to make sure, you know, just in case that,
yeah.
you know, if I was born 5 days after he died and a day after his funeral.
It's so amazing, and for you to know that, as you said, not only is he your father, but the conditions around it, that he actually wanted you, because I'm sure a lot of children, and I think you've got involved in that side of things as far as adoption, you know, people, that's not always the case, and I guess to find out that you weren't wanted can be quite devastating for a child.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I tell people, in that book, we've written a 20th anniversary, which it's also called Lost and Found. You know, the thing about it is I tell people that foster or adoption, you've really got to be at the right, not necessarily the right age, but the right mental age, maturity, because, you know, I said, always expect the worst and hope for the best, because you can make that phone call and they can say, and this I've heard this from other people, they'd make that contact and they go, I didn't want you then and I don't want you now. Well, you know, as long as you don't know, you can
right.
you can pretty much fantasize how you want that part of your life to play out. But I also think, too, for most people, and I've asked a lot of adopted kids and stuff, are you sorry, even on the worst case, are you sorry you did it? Did you go and you did the search? And every time I've heard, you know, I didn't like what I heard, but I made that contact, I can put it behind me, and I can move on. But, you know, I do think today with everything, I think attitudes are a little different, and, you know, there's not as much what do you want from me kind of a thing, you know. I think there's more bonding, but you know, it's a tough decision for people to have, if they so choose to make it. They really need to be prepared mentally, because you have to live with that for the rest of your life.
And I was reading in the book that it's your belief that those who are adopted, at some point, especially if their biological parents have passed away, that they should be able to find out their names and I guess something about them.
Oh, you know, the thing about it is, you know, and also, too, you have to remember, nowadays, with medical history, it is really critical. You know, if you've got a heads up that your mother had breast cancer or cancer runs in your father's
right.
Or diabetes or things like this that can give you, you know, just an awareness of your own personal, because I remember going and you'd fill out your medical thing and they'd say, you know, mother's history, dad's history, and you just have to put N.A., you know,
right.
But I really, I mean, in you know, whether or not, you know, you might have kidney disease, you know, and things you might be able to do, diet or I don't, you know, just there's, so there's things like that. But the other, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, people sometimes give up a child to go into not being, contacted, and they go on to have another life. So, you know, there's part of the thing to where if you don't have that privacy, there's a lot of women, I think, would not give a child up for adoption, you know, because of the fear factor. Well, I don't want them to come in 20 years from now, you know,
right.
So, a lot of people, when
yep.
you have that thing, when you sign it away, no contact, you have to look at it from that perspective, too.
True
but
enough.
Usually, I don't know in Canada, but I think one of the things is now that they put a letter in there that at a certain time, if you so choose to do so, they will contact that family, and if they agree to it, then they'll let you meet. But let me just say this: I'm all for adoption and foster home because every kid needs a home and they need love. You know, and it's one thing to be in a foster home or whatever, but it's another thing when you actually walk through someone's door and they wrap their arms around you and they love you because, you know, it's that old saying, I love you because you're my brother, but I don't really love you. You know, I'm obligated to you because of
right.
blood, but sometimes people are actually closer to someone else, you know, emotionally. So you can have that bond.
So true, and it's amazing the story that you've just told, and again, it's in your book, and you mentioned now there's a 20th anniversary of that. Is that available to purchase, like, online and so forth?
Right. They can go on my website at jetwilliams@jetwilliams.com or just type in Jet Williams. But the other thing, Dave, think about this young man, 29 years old. He's the superstar. He's the hottest thing in the country, and Bobby Jett, my natural mother, she was actually 31 years old. So you're not talking about like a young, you know, 17, 18-year-old star-crossed young
sure.
lady. So you're talking about a 31-year-old woman here who actually went and lived with his mother, okay, during my pregnancy from August, September, October, November, and December, January, lived there. But it also shows you what a man and what a stand-up human being this man, Hank Williams, was, because he did not run from his responsibilities. He stepped up to the plate and said, I am the father, and I take full responsibility. And I think that that shows you why that man could write songs like that. I mean, he might have lived them, but he also, as I said, did not run from his responsibility. And he stepped up and said, I'm the father, and this is my baby, and I want my baby.
That's an amazing thing to know about him, and for you to know, especially in your life, very meaningful. And you, I guess, in search of your story here and your life story, one of the calls you made at the time was to Charles Carr. Now, he's the young man, 19 at the time, who drove your dad the night he died, drove him to these concerts and the one that didn't take place. What was it like to talk to him and get some insight from him?
Well, a couple of things. One, he was 17 when he drove my dad.
Ah, okay.
And he was a pickup driver. The original driver canceled at the last minute, and so then my dad went down to the taxi stand, and it was run by a Mr. Carr, and his son, Charles Carr, was home on Christmas vacation from Auburn University. And so Charles drove my dad. Well, I just, you know, back then when I was during my search, I looked in the phone book, and I found his name, and I called him, just out of the blue.
Wow.
And, you know, he knew all about, you know, well, he gave me some information, and he sort of pointed me in the directions that I needed to be looking for. I mean, he's the one that gave me the name Bobby Jett. And so, you know, as I said, of course, then I hit the state of Alabama, what down here we call Pensions and Security, which, you know, runs the adoption records and all that, and, you know, everything was sealed, and so I had to go through all of that. But Charles Carr is still alive in Montgomery.
Amazing. Amazing. And he was able to tell you some things that happened that night, or details at all, or what kinds of things did you talk about?
Charles Carr has always been very close-mouthed about that last ride of my dad. In fact, a movie's getting ready to come out here in the States. I hope it goes to Canada, called The Last Ride. But, you know, the thing about what happened during those last 72 hours of that last ride, there's a lot of holes, but there's a lot of things that happened that never made it into the history books. As in, there was more than one driver, and there's other things. In fact, my husband and I are researching it because we're not happy with what the thing is of just my dad died of a heart attack.
Because
I've gotten the autopsy reports, and we've been gathering a lot of information, and things are starting to look a lot different than what was reported.
Very interesting. Now the movie you mentioned, The Last Ride, I've been online and watched some of the previews of it. Overall, do you think it's a good movie? Are you looking forward to it coming out?
Oh, I love it. I really do. I've been to several of the film festivals, and it's an interesting movie because it never mentions the name Hank Williams. And the actor that plays my dad never sings or plays the guitar.
Interesting.
You've got what it is. It's when a boy becomes a man and a man becomes a legend, it's mostly between the driver and my dad. And what happens in the movie? The first thing that starts is my dad stopping at the doctor's to pay for the baby, which would be me, and. What happens is the man that is playing my dad is traveling under a traveling name. Now, you know it's Hank Williams, and everybody knows it's Hank Williams, but nobody will say Hank Williams.
Okay.
And he's trying to get to the show, and, of course, you know, the weather interferes and all these things interfere. And during the driving everything, the young man, he's 17, he's never owned a radio, okay, and doesn't like music, so he doesn't even know who he's driving. And you know, so
pretty ironic.
Very, very, yeah. I mean, but the thing about it is, there's scenes in it like where they're in a diner and Tony Bennett comes on singing "Cold Cold Heart," and my dad asks the driver, he says, "Do you like that song?" And he says, "Well, yeah, it's okay." And then the guy playing my dad says, "I hate that damn song," you know. But it's really, you know, it's very, very thought provoking. It rattles around in your head. There is a soundtrack to it, and of course, it's got, you know, Kitty Wells, Ernest Tubb, Johnny Cash, you know. So I've got some cuts in the movie, but it's very thought provoking, and it's one of these movies to where even if you didn't know Hank Williams and you didn't like country music, you'd still like the movie. But if you do love Hank Williams, it's a movie about the man, not him just singing a song after song after song. It's not a biopic. It's a
right.
real deep movie. It's, as my husband says, it's almost dark, but it's not.
Now, is that is, as you mentioned, going to be released in the States this summer sometime or the fall?
In September.
In September, great.
I think your
life story would make a great movie. I mean, there's so many interesting twists and turns and just everything about it. I think that would be a great movie.
Well, I think what my husband would like to do is get this other movie off, and there's also supposedly a HBO movie in the works here in the United States on my dad, and then I think after we get those launched that we may then go ahead and look toward the Jet story.
That would be very cool. Off the top of your head, you may not want to say now, but is there anybody you can see portraying you in the movie? Any actress favorite of yours?
Well, they were going to write this book 20 years ago, and all the people I picked now can't play me because they've gotten too old. And the other thing, too, is I said, there's got to be two or three of me, you know, because you're going through a lifetime. And I said, I can't wait to meet me as a child.
Oh, that's
terrific.
Well,
it would, depending on when you made the movie, you know, I don't know if say, 5 years, because, you know, today so many talents come out of nowhere nowadays, you know. So it would just depend on the timing of whoever. But whoever did it, I would want them to actually read the story and, you know, have it move them, not just be another
right.
part for them to play. I mean, I would want them to actually, you know, really, you know, have that feeling in their heart, because I think that would make the difference between just being a movie and being something that would be wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. That takes that extra feeling and commitment to a movie to take it to that level. On that subject, did you enjoy Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash story? Did that movie appeal to you?
Yeah, it did, but it was more just, you know, the biopic. The thing that is, like, even with the movie I'm like on my dad or whatever, I want to know what made the man, you know. I know it was a God-given talent, but,
yeah.
You know, I want to know more than just the, you know, well, here, you know, he was born poor, you know, and he met his first wife. They didn't get along and fought the whole time, and he sang, and then he drank some, and then they got divorced, and he married another one, and then he died. You know, those movies on these bio things, you've really got to get in, to me, to make it the classic, you've got to get into that person and what made them that musical genius. You know,
and you've got to see them as a human being, as you said, not sort of somebody going through the motions and just giving you the facts. You want to see what made them live and breathe and feel the emotion they did.
Yeah, exactly. Not just, you know, just like on that Patsy Cline movie, you know, so Jessica Lange comes to Nashville, it's like, okay, fine, you're a star, you're fine, plane crashes. You know, it's like, it wasn't like that. It was hard. I mean, you know, the disappointments and you know, all of that, sleeping on park benches and, you know, even with my dad, the demons that he had to fight and all the people that were depending on him, all of that, I think, you know, goes past just the straight formula, so to speak.
Definitely. Now, Jet, when did music come into your life? I mean, on your 21st birthday, you learned you were the daughter of Hank Williams, but it was before that you enjoyed music and were into music. How did you first get that bug to perform?
Well, I think I was born with it, and the reason I say that is because when I got all my adoption records, every time I changed homes or places or whatever, they said I was carrying my guitar. And I've got pictures that were given to me later, and there's one in the book of where I'm sitting on my grandmother's steps at two, and I've got a cowboy hat and a guitar. And my adoption records have that when my the social worker would come visit my grandmother, the social worker notes that I am on the dining room table with my guitar singing Your Cheating Heart, or attempting to. I would probably would be a better.
Right.
But the fact that my, you know, that I was already, you know, as a small toddler or whatever, was already into that. And as far as I know, I always played guitar and, you know, loved music and sang and had a little group. And, you know, so it's always been a part of my life. I can't imagine, I can't even remember not playing.
Isn't that something, even though you hadn't met your father at that time, obviously he had passed away, and you've only known him through recordings, but even before you knew that he was your father, music was in you. So I guess it's something that's in the blood, isn't it? It's in the genes.
Oh, absolutely. I tell people, too, you know, about, you know, we were talking about medical. I said, just remember you inherit the good genes as well as the bad ones. That's something to be aware of, you know.
Exactly. Now, so when did songwriting first come to you? When do you recall writing your first songs, attempting to?
I was writing a long time ago because I remember I used to have this little bound book and I was writing and everything, and my adopted mother saw it and she never really praised me or anything very much, and so I kind of tried to downplay it, and she said, "Oh no, honey, you need to hold on to these because they may be worth something someday." And I thought, well, that's really weird. You know, and then later when I found out, but I would write songs. I'd go to a slumber party, and I'd write songs about the girls at the slumber party, about, you know, your date and so, and I'd write all these sad songs, and then I'd make everybody cry, and then I'd be happy.
So there was something there, definitely, wasn't there? Something passed down.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that movie, The Last Ride, I've got two original cuts in it.
Oh, great. That's great. We'll look forward. So, and what can you tell us about the songs?
What, the two for the movie?
Yeah, for the movie.
Well, one of them is called the Hank Williams Blues, which they play at the end, and it's just kind of an autobiographical song I wrote about my dad. And then the other one was just a song that they put in. It was kind of a love song that they needed for a scene, and so.
Very nice. Well, we'll look forward to that and the soundtrack being available, too. There's a song here in Canada that's just been released in the last couple of weeks, an artist here, one of our top artists within Canada, Gord Bamford, and the song is called Hank Williams Lonesome.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's about how he's not just lonesome. Yeah, you should check that out online, Gord Bamford, Hank Williams Lonesome. A great new song, very traditional, but refers to your father and all that great stuff. We're going to get to the Mother's Best recordings in just a few moments, talking all about that. There's so much to cover there. But when you were introduced on the Opry, the first time you walked there, you were introduced as the daughter of Hank Williams. What was that moment like, Jet?
It was awesome. I mean, you know, to one, be able to make that walk out there to that circle, but then to actually have that country blessing, so to speak, in the announcement as I made that appearance. And so, you know, I have been truly blessed.
I also want to talk about some of the different encounters you've had, different friendships with many of the country stars. A great story about George Jones I was reading online
mm-hmm.
earlier. I'll have you share that. But let's turn to music, and this time we're going to let you share the music. It's your version of Your Cheating Heart from your CD called Honk. Tell us about the recording the song. And you mentioned that it's one of the ones you attempted to sing so many years ago.
Well, this cut, instead of doing it, you know, on the exactly like the way my dad did, is I just put a little different feel to it, and I think the way the original version of Your Cheating Heart is, it's like someone's not really bitter, but, you know, they were saying, you know, your cheating heart's going to tell on you, to where
right.
The way I tried to do it, it's more like older, looking back over, say, a lost love, and kind of a melancholy feeling to it. It's like, you know, your cheating heart will tell on you someday, as opposed to it, you know, actually happening at that moment and being so hurt.
Right. So you know, time has passed, and it's more of a reflection.
Exactly.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's share the version. A great song, of course, sung by our guest, Jet Williams, Your Cheatin' Heart, here on In the Country.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down, I fall in rain. You'll talk around and call my name. You'll walk the floor the way I do. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Into the Mother's Best recordings, discovered they were recorded back in the early 50s when your father was touring and on the road and he couldn't do the radio show live at WSM. They were put to acetate, and then they were kind of tossed out in the 70s in a garbage bin, and somebody took them out and kept them for a while. Tell us about that.
Well, up to that point, you're absolutely right. And then from there, the acetates came into my hands, except during the 70s, a bootleg copy of some of them, not all of them, were made. And so Time Rocks goes along, and then what happens is a company buys that bootleg, and then they try and take my dad's voice off, add a band. Anyway, Hank Jr. and I together sue this company, and then the record company jumps in. And so Polydorm, Polygram, we sued them. And anyway, we prevail in the courts here in the United States, and they awarded us the ownership of these 147 songs that you have never heard Hank Williams sing before, unless you were listening to him sing that day. And what we did was we partnered with Time Life and created a wonderful box set that I got a Grammy nomination for as executive producer last year. And you can get it online at mothersbest.com. Time Life, and it is unbelievable. It also it has a big box set. It's got 15 CDs. It's got a DVD CD on it, where I interview the guy that was the engineer, and Don Hems, who was played on it, and
yeah.
Big Bill Lister. And it's got a 100-page-plus book in it. And the fidelity of these recordings are better than the MGM Masters. And you get him singing
amazing
songs like Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, Where the Old Red River Flows, When the Saints Come Marching In, On Top of Old Smoky, all of these songs you've never heard before, as well as Cold, Cold Heart, Hey, Good Looking, I Saw the Light. And it is a true treasure trove of Hank Williams music. And he
so
also
this
does
is
a lot of Luke the Drifters.
Yeah, and a chance for not only you to learn about your father through different songs, first time hearing the songs that he had written, but we as well as fans get to hear a different side of him and get to know him better after all these years.
Well, actually, you're right, because he MCs the show, and you get
yeah.
to see, you hear his personality. You hear he's very relaxed. He keeps the show tight, but he tells you why he wrote a song, why he's singing the song. He makes fun of himself. He tells jokes. He cuts up. He makes mistakes. You actually get to meet the guy, Hank Williams, and you find out that he's a wonderful person. He's the kind of guy you want to be your friend.
It's the complete Mother's Best Recordings. You can go online to check it out, and you can listen to samples, watch a bit of the video as well of the DVD that accompanies it. I recommend that to everyone. Also, I recommend checking out Ain't Nothing As Sweet As My Baby, the story of Hank Williams' lost daughter, written in 1990. There's a new updated version as well called Lost and Found, of course, the story of Jed Williams. Before we go, as we wrap up here, Jed, can you share the story briefly about meeting George Jones and how excited he was to meet the daughter of Hank Williams?
I will, but I want to just tell all the good folks this. I was very fortunate. Someone years ago gave me these acetates, and it's my dad when he was 15 years old singing. And so this coming September, we are putting out another box set, and you will have the first recordings of my dad along with the health and happiness shows that he did. And
wow.
I want everybody to be watching for that. But to get to the George
Amazing.
Jones story. It came over I was doing a book signing and the phone rang, and it was George Jones telling me he wanted to come, but the traffic was too bad, and would I save him a book? And I said, well, yes, sir. And he said, my husband and I be kind enough to have dinner with he and his wife? And I said, well, yeah. And so we pull into it was the Cock of the Walk here in Nashville. And so my husband is a huge George Jones fan, so he grabbed his camera as we're getting out and everything, and I said, oh, man, don't take pictures. You know, I said, let's eat dinner and, you know, see how things go and everything, and then you know, if things are going real good, maybe we'll ask if we have pictures. So we start walking toward the restaurant, and all of a sudden somebody jumps out from behind a car, and they start taking our picture and everything, and I look, and I thought, is that George Jones? And he was waiting in the parking lot with his camera to take pictures of us. So
we got
pictures of us taking pictures of each other taking pictures. Anyway, we go in and we have dinner, and it's just great. I mean, two, 3 hours we sat visiting and everything. And when we left, he looked at me and he said, can I ask you something? I said, yes, sir. He says, would you be kind enough to give me your autograph? And
wow.
I thought I was going to die. I said, well, yes, sir, if you'll give me yours. And he has been he and Nancy have been absolutely wonderful to my husband and I through all these years. And they are true blue, great people, honest to God.
He's a great legend, just like your father, Hank Williams. A great story. You just told great stories in the book as well. And JedWilliams.com is the website. People can follow you there and check up on all the latest stuff. So many exciting things going on. Thanks so much for the time, Jed. Been a real pleasure to speak with you.
You too, Dave, and you keep it going up there, okay?
I will do that for sure. Awesome. Once again, my guest today has been Jed Williams on this very special edition of In the Country.